Welcome to What in God's Name? She's Shayna Appel.
And he is Chris Owen.
It's great to see you, Shayna.
It's great to be here, Chris.
Did you have a good vacation?
I had a wonderful vacation, and as you and I sit here today, I am aware of the fact that half of our nation is being blanketed in a pretty serious storm. So we're sending good thoughts to our listeners out there and hope everybody stays safe out there.
We're doing current events and culture from a philosophical and theological point of view. And generally, we have Arlo with us. Arlo is Shayna's Shih Tzu, but Arlo is still at Arlo's babysitter for vacation time.
Arlo is still on vacation.
And so I'm missing Arlo, but Shayna, I have to say, I looked on Instagram at hashtag Shih Tzu, and there are literally hundreds of thousands of pictures of Shih Tzus on Instagram, and I just wanted to ask you, is this a cult?
Probably. But I want to ask you, are any of them as cute as Arlo? They're pretty cute dogs.
There's some pretty cute pictures.
There's some
of
pretty
Shih
cute
Tzus.
Dogs. I'll have to check it out. I haven't looked.
I wanted to share also with our audience and with you that we have gone over 1,000 listens.
Woo-hoo!
For our podcast, which is a very modest achievement, but it's a milestone.
Significant
to mark.
For us,
it's
yes.
Nice to see that. So thank you all for listening. And finally, a note on What in God's Name. Shayna and I will be at a conference coming up, and we will be recording a show with a live audience. And so I'm really looking forward to doing that with you, Shayna, and with the people who will be there, because we want to invite people to be in conversation with us and co-creators and co-producers. So I'm looking forward to that.
Wonderful. Yeah, I'm excited about that too. Can't wait to have all our peeps together in one room. And I think it's going to be a great show. We've got a great workshop set out. And so I'm really excited to do it.
Today's show is the second half of a conversation that I recorded with Dr. Gordon Graham, who recently retired as a philosophy professor at Princeton Theological Seminary. Part one of that conversation played last Thursday. Part two we have today, we'll play it for you just coming up in a moment, and then Shayna and I will respond to it. Since we're going into the second half of a conversation, I just wanted to help our listeners understand where we are in the conversation. The question, the general topic of the question that I'm asking Dr. Graham as we join the interview is about the difference between political and theological categories. So let's listen now to Dr. Graham as he responds to this question, and then Shayna and I'll be back in for some reflections of our own. My denomination is the United Church of Christ, which I wasn't brought up in that denomination, ordained into it. I find that our church's advocacy tends to be cheerleading for the Democratic Party.
Yes.
And I keep thinking about the ways that the church can be faithful in proclaiming a different vision that doesn't get collapse into the categories that we're already operating under.
Well, you see, in the class I offer, political philosophy and public theology, at the end of the course, I devote a few sessions to this question of Christians in politics. How are they to be engaged? And I discuss the various possibilities. I mean, it's a recurrent theme, of course. You get it in this country, but you get it further afield as well. And that is political quietism, that religion has no place in politics. Keep religion out of politics. No politics in the pulpit and so on. Now, it's not just here. I mean, that is the position of, for example, the Coptic Orthodox Church in Egypt. And there are understandable reasons for that. It was the position of the Russian Orthodox Church across the whole of the Soviet Union. Just stay out of it. We, particularly liberal Protestant denominations and some Catholics and so on, are much more alive to the necessity of some kind of engagement. But then the question is, what kind of engagement? And what I invite the students to think about is two possibilities. One as Christian advocacy, and the other as Christian witness. Now, the thing about Christian advocacy, which is very fashionable in a sense, I mean, the Lutheran Church has a whole network of advocacy ministries, and the Episcopal Church, in one or two places, but particularly in New Jersey, has joined up with that. But the point about advocacy is it can address and does address serious evils. For instance, the question of solitary confinement in the state of New Jersey. That's just one I happen to be talking about recently. But there's a couple of interesting things here. Where does the theological component, where does the Christian component come in? Because if you're going to advocate successfully for the abolition of, let us say, solitary confinement, then you need to get to gather support wherever you find it. So you need to ally yourself with all of those who are willing to advocate for an end to a solitary confinement, an end to mass incarceration. You need to ally yourself with everybody from whatever quarter. Now, if you say, if you raise up quite prominently the religious or theological grounds, the Christian grounds for doing so, then you threaten those alliances. You don't strengthen them. And so there is just a natural push in Christian advocacy to let the Christian bit slide into the background. That's just how it goes. If you want to bring the Christian bit right into the forefront, then as a Christian witness, then you may have to accept that your witnessing must be indifferent to success. So the important point is to bear witness, not to get things done. And when I talk about these things to my students, they always divide up in one or two ways. Those who take the point about advocacy say, yeah, I see that actually we would be diluting the things we believe and stand in order to get the widest possible rainbow coalition. And others who say, but what's the point of witnessing if it never accomplishes anything? So we're taken in these two directions. But accomplishing something matters in terms of witnessing only if you are witnessing to a specific task or cause. But if your witness is against presentism, against consumerism, against human superbia or hubris with respect to salvation, if that's where your witness is, then what was being effective mean or not mean? We can rest easy with that. The important point is to tell it like it is.
That you could preach that.
You could.
In fact, I might.
But you get the point about advocacy versus witness.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, we're all agree. Let's all just agree that quietism is not on the cards. We shouldn't just take our religion off into the corner. We can. I mean, when the Copts and so on, there's big issues for them. You know, it's a dangerous world out there. So I'm not. I think we shouldn't be critical of them. But let's just agree that at least in this world, we don't need to shut ourselves up, and that is a kind of indifference.
I think I mentioned to you in one of my emails about Rowan Williams.
Yes.
And this distinction he makes between programmatic secularism and procedural secularism. My understanding is that I find understanding what he means by procedural secularism easier than understanding any other one. As I understand procedural secularism, it's this notion that the public space is contended and can be contended, but government acts as a kind of a referee. So, and then programmatic would be secularism as an end, that religion then is much more a private thing. We want to keep our religion private. He says France is an example of programmatic secularism. Do you find that distinction or that analysis to be helpful in any way?
Well, the only thing is that, it's clear, and it's clear in this country with respect to the separation of church and state, and in France, it's clear that the rule of law is meant in some sense to be neutral with respect to any religious affiliations. And Rawls, who I mentioned earlier, is the great theorist of that. The rules governing our life together must not incorporate or depend upon what he calls any comprehensive moral vision. It's not just... Now, actually, it is very hard to separate the procedural from the programmatic in just this sense, that then becomes the ideal, not just the rules by which we are governed, but it becomes the ideal that unites us. So you can think of it this way. We all, obviously, it makes sense to drive on one side of the road, not any old side of the road. So we need a rule. And the rule could be drive on the right, it could be drive on the left. It doesn't really matter. So this is pure proceduralism. There's nothing programmatic about that. It's not... Now, occasionally, these procedural rules take on symbolic significance, and so people think we're the kind of people who drive on the left, or we're the kind of people who drive on the right. But that example shows it to be silly, but it's not silly in other cases where a procedural rule actually is elevated into a symbol. The conflict, I think, with religion, properly so-called, is not new, and it's actually quite ancient. It is the same reason that the Jews had problems with the Roman Empire, and indeed with many of their conquerors, and it's exactly the same issue as you get in the story of Daniel. It's the same issue you get when the early Christians could not join the Roman army because they were required to worship the emperor. So if you fast forward all these centuries, I think you find the real clash and conflict here is the way in which in the United States, the veneration of the military and those who have served in the military, that veneration is something that it's a religion, it's a sacred boundary. You cannot say, but look, these people operating drones are not laying their lives on the line. What line are they laying their lives on? You can't say those who died in Vietnam were simply victims of a huge mistake, or Iraq. So there is this litany of praise for the armed forces that actually has this idolatrous element. And of course, the churches often feed that idolatry. And they have the flag. Somebody pointed out to me at church once, it was, the flag was higher than the cross. So the secularized procedures quickly take on a programmatic element, and with it, elements of symbolism, often that echo historical memory. And those historical memories and the echo of them are often used precisely to gloss and deflect us from the truth. But to expose them is to expose yourself to a lot of anger and ire. And so if you wanted to witness against idolatry in this country and the idolatrous attitude to the armed forces, that would be a witness. It could be costly. And it's no good saying, it's irrelevant to say, yeah, but would you have any effect? You don't tear down the idols in order to have effect. As St. Paul says, there aren't any idols. They don't exist. It's only that people wrongly venerate something as God that is not God.
Gordon, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
What a wonderful time to just sit and talk. So I appreciate that.
Chris, the two points that Dr. Graham makes that jumped out for me concern the role of political quietism and his very clear distinction between advocacy and witness.
Yeah. So the first one, he says, political quietism, in his view, shouldn't be on the table for us in the United States. I think he's saying that we who are grounded in faith have not just an opportunity, but almost an obligation.
An obligation. I know when it's come up in my churches where some in the pews have felt that politics has no place in religion, I've found myself scratching my head and wondering what book they're reading, because I cannot imagine preaching the gospel without preaching the politic that is woven inextricably into it. If we read the gospel story, particularly by the time we get to the passion, Jesus's crucifixion, you know, Jesus was murdered by Romans. History, by the way, would tend to agree with me, because history will say that crucifixion was only utilized on recalcitrant criminals and insurrectionists, which as a Christian makes me wonder, so who are we worshiping, a recalcitrant criminal or an insurrectionist? I would argue the latter. We worship an insurrectionist, somebody who came to flip the existing power structure on its head. So I don't know how to preach the gospel without preaching the politic of it. One cannot look at the people to whom Jesus was preaching and not see people who were inherently an oppressed class. I mean, if you miss that, you just miss so much color and depth in the gospel message. So I've never understood really how one can keep politics. I don't know. How do you roll with that?
I think what people get turned off by, and understandably so, is how religion gets allied with a particular political party.
My advocacy is not going to be on behalf of the Democratic Party, but on behalf of ideals which are now showing themselves in the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. So I'm not preaching, I will never preach what I'm preaching because I'm a Democrat or because I'm a Republic. I will preach it because it is the gospel.
I am in agreement with you that the gospel can't be preached without reference to politics writ large, how we order our common life together. That's what I understand by politics writ large. How do we do that in a way that is faithful? And I think you've articulated how you think about it and approach it in a faithful way rather than a partisan way. So I'm trying to put my mind around the aversion and why the aversion of some people to politics and religion mixing.
I think sometimes what happens, forgive the term, on the left, among the more liberal preachers is that sometimes we make the political case, we don't deeply ground it enough in the scriptural, so that what the person in the pew is hearing is something that sounds more like a political message, because unfortunately so many in the pews these days are not as scripturally literate as they may have been 40, 50 years ago. We may be thinking we're engaging in a high context conversation when in fact the conversation is being heard as a lower context conversation and people are missing the connections.
That's thank you. That's helpful. And I think on the right, it's the obverse of that, which is
absolutely
taking the Bible, the scripture, and saying, here's what should be political. Here's how the Bible tells us how to order our political life.
Yes, and without any effort whatsoever to deal with the politic of the Bible in its own time or in ours.
Man, and this is difficult and hard, but this is why we're doing, this is part again, why we're doing this show, is to push at these difficult distinctions, but distinctions that really need to be made for the good of our society, I think, because the religious voice does need to be heard, and for the good of the gospel.
And different religious voices need to be heard.
Yes.
Because that's the big, you know, when younger people think all religion is messed up, it's largely because they have no idea what's going on in the religious realm writ large.
Let's talk about the distinction that Gordon made between Christian advocacy and Christian witness.
I thought that was fascinating.
It's a basic distinction in moral philosophy between consequentialist ways of thinking, which have to do with determining the goodness of some action by its results. So that's consequentialist ways of thinking. And he was equating Christian advocacy with consequentialist ways of thinking. In other words, you determine whether your advocacy has been successful or not
by its outcome.
On the results.
Right.
On the outcome. And then on the other hand, he raises up this Christian witness, which is not consequentialist. the effectiveness of witness is not whether it leads to results. And in fact, as he says, in a lot of situations, it doesn't even make sense to ask, was it effective? Did it work? Rather, the point of Christian witness is simply to speak the truth as we see it.
You know, it's funny when I think about great movements in our time and things that have ultimately had consequentialists out, they've produced something, but it all begins as witness, doesn't it? Somebody has to just stand up and say, this is wrong. And at first, everyone will say, that's outrageous, and you need to be burned to the stake or tarred and feathered or cast into prison. You know, and eventually, as more and more people catch on, the witnessing, it all starts in witness. I think we can't be afraid to witness.
Right. And it, as Gordon points out, that can be dangerous.
Witnessing can be dangerous. I would agree. Going to my former point, witnessing can be dangerous because it usually is what precedes public awareness. The one that Gordon brought up, I thought was incredibly insightful, particularly within this country, and is something that I have to confess I have thought of myself. And that has to do with this country's veneration of the military and those who serve in the military. Let me be clear, because I don't wish to take away from those who serve in the military and the families that support them, much less those who make the ultimate sacrifice and the families who live with those losses. That having been said, I have seen over and over again how the over-veneration of our military often casts others into shadows that they should not be cast into. When I hear stories of these, you know, school shootings, and I hear about teachers who literally put their bodies in between gunfire and their students, are those people any less worthy of our veneration than our military heroes? I don't think so. We're eclipsing this huge mass of goodness that you know, we don't see. But man, if you, God forbid, you know, you're going to be the person standing out in the public square saying that, you're not a patriot, you're anti-American. Or worse.
Yeah. I think about how the over-veneration of the military, what effect that has on our society as a whole. What role does that veneration play? Mm. And Gordon is suggesting that it deflects us from examining what's true. It's a diversion in a way. As we live in an age that seems to be more divided and polarized.
Us against them.
Here's a way we can, there are symbols we can rally around, and
right.
Here are people that we can lift up as heroes.
Right. Perhaps the military is the one thing we can get behind.
Yeah.
And I would much rather we get behind the goodness that is in many different people and spans, you know, let's start lifting that up.
Yeah. It's harder though, because the military has readily identifiable symbols, the flag, the uniform.
Going back to Gordon's comment about, you know, how the veneration of one thing over all others can obscure the truth. Things like who we attack, when we attack them, and was that in fact the right thing to do? Kind of gets us into the whole just war theory thing. But, you know, following the attacks on this country on 9/11, 2001, you know, we went off and attacked a country that in retrospect had nothing to do with those attacks. But we're so busy venerating the military that to even call that into question is seen as anti-American, is seen as anti-patriot. Whereas I think a careful assessment of that whole situation needs to be done in order for us to be more responsible with the military power that we have amassed in this country. When do we use it? How do we use it? Without looking at those hard... If all we're doing is elevating that, then we end up in that pot where, you know, if all you have is a hammer, everything around you is going to look like a nail. So, you know, yeah, who needs diplomats? We've got the greatest military in the world. Let's just unleash them.
Right. So that leads me to ask you about... I think the unnamed piece of this is violence. And this brings me back to how you opened this conversation a little bit, talking about Jesus as the victim of
violence,
violence from the Roman Empire because he was an insurrectionist proclaiming a different kingdom than the kingdom, than the emperor of Rome. So violence.
Creating a positive narrative following Jesus's death, which takes us into the resurrection theology, which says no matter how bad something is, fear not, for God will do something with it. God will make something of our ashes.
Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shed some light.
You have been with What in God's Name for the last half hour. I'm Shana Appel.
And I'm Chris Owen, and we're so grateful for you to listen. Again, check us out at our website, whatingods.com, WHATINGODS. Next week, we are not having a show. We will take a break, and we will join you again on Thursday, March the 7th. Until then, take care.
Be well, and God bless.